Hello and welcome to the Sewers of Paris. We're on a podcast adventure to discover the entertainment that changed the lives of gay men. Join us on tonight's episode when my guest David says...
I've made out with a man this weekend. I've been to a club with a slide in the middle of it. Like, I've seen people doing drugs. How am I going to go back and turn in my science homework?
The topic is Madonna, the Go-Go's, and Sia. By the way, The Sewers of Paris is independent, ad-free, and listener-supported. Huge thanks to folks like Ali, who are keeping the show going for as little as a dollar an episode. Just go to sewersofparis.com and click Support the Show on Patreon. Now, what is it about strong women that gay men find so irresistible? Whether it's a Golden Girl, or Bayonetta, or, as in the case for this week's guest, Madonna, there's something extra inspiring to us about the women who run the world. So it's no wonder that David Russell's dedicated his career to supporting fabulous lady performers. For the last few years, he's managed Sia, the Australian singer-songwriter, and his path to success was paved with heroines like Wonder Woman, Belinda Carlisle, and an extremely understanding family. A family who stood up for him when he wanted to dance, and stood up to school officials who were so scared of having a gay student that they wouldn't even allow David to talk. Hello, welcome to the Sewers of Paris. I'm talking today to David Russell. He manages Sia at Crush Music. Thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure.
So what is the entertainment that changed your life?
The entertainment that changed my life really would have to be anything by Madonna. But since we're talking on June 30th, 2016, today's the 30th anniversary of the release of the True Blue album. And I would say, truly, that any project Madonna's released in her entire career, of any of those projects, True Blue is the one that really changed my life. It solidified Madonna on a worldwide scale as one of the premier icons of pop. But for 10-year-old me, it definitively put Madonna at, I would say, the top of the totem pole for me when it comes to pop music.
So, 10-year-old you, describe to me, like, how you got that album.
Well, I was so I got into Madonna, you know, right when she came out, and then got really obsessed with Madonna because I had a babysitter who bought me the 7-inch single for Material Girl, because I loved the video so much, because really I just wanted to look like Madonna in the Material Girl video. She really looks like Marilyn Monroe, but 9-year-old me didn't really know that. What I liked about her look was that she had a gigantic pink bow on her head at one point, a very short section of the video actually, but that really stuck with me, this pink bow. I think really my main attraction to Madonna at that point, and this just came to me now, is because she vaguely looked like Nellie Olson from the Little House on the Prairie series.
Working hard, doing just fine. You should look nicer when you come to work in a store. Maybe your mother would let you wear your Sunday dress.
My Sunday dress is for church.
Well, you don't get paid for going to church. And I don't worship in Olsen's Mercantile.
In that video in particular, she had ringlet curls and a big pink bow. The first female archetypes I was obsessed with as a child were Wonder Woman, Linda Carter's Wonder Woman, and Nellie Olson. And so Madonna, in a strange way, is a combination of Wonder Woman and Nellie Olson, isn't she?
That is a fascinating comparison.
Right? Well, there you go. That was what drew me in. And so I was super aware of Madonna and super into MTV. And just from a very young age, was really obsessed with music and pop music in particular. And so I was really, really ready for what was coming next. And as a kid in the 80s, it was impossible to avoid the influence of MTV, and so I'm certain there were commercials for True Blue, and then the first single rolled out, I want to say at the very end of 1985, early 1986, which was the ballad Live to Tell from At Close Range, and that's when I knew there was new Madonna coming. And I just begged and begged and begged for it once the posters started going up, and I actually got it for Christmas of 1986, so how I went 6 months without the album, I don't know, and I'm sure my parents, I'm sure it was unbearable. But that's how I became aware of it. That album in particular has what I think are her most defining videos and singles of her career. I really do think that the True Blue era begins what was for Madonna a really long imperial period, sort of an untouchable, at the top of the charts period for her, and that's from like 86, I would say, till 93. That really started it all. And so I have a Madonna tattoo based on True Blue. So
wow. Where is it?
On my chest right here, I have Open Your Heart in the blue typeface, exactly the same as the back of the album. I've had to work much harder. I got that 3 years ago in Provincetown. Yeah. Took me a long time.
Well, I was going to say, is it something you've been thinking about?
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, I wanted a Madonna tattoo for my very first tattoo ever. But I was always scared to get one because I didn't know what to get. I love so much of her career, and so much of it is really iconic and important to me. But my favorite song by Madonna is Open Your Heart. It's my favorite video. It was directed by Jean-Baptiste Mondino, who's one of my favorite photographers and video directors. And I've become really good friends in real life with the little boy from that video, Felix Howard. And so it just all came together, and I just thought, this is the only one that makes sense for me.
So you, like, were you there in Provincetown, and you were like, all right, today's the day?
I was, actually, yeah. I just, I was there with my best friend, Derek, and my friend, Jimmy. There's something about Provincetown, anyway, that inspires the inherent queerness in me. It's sort of like its own nook for the queer community. And I've been going there my whole life, and then generally every summer as an adult with my best friend. And so I find when I'm in that town, I'm always inspired to do things I wouldn't normally do, or to maybe explore parts of myself I wouldn't normally explore. And getting a Madonna tattoo, something so overtly queer and so important to me in that place, just made sense.
Were your friends like, were they supportive?
Oh my God, yeah, please. Anyone who knows me knows how important Madonna is, so if they want to be my friend, they'll be supportive. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah, I can imagine being like, all right, finally he's getting
this. Oh, yeah, yeah, my friend Derek, definitely. We've been friends since I was 15, so he knew for, or 16, so he knew for sure, yeah.
When you show people off to, do they recognize it, or are they like, oh my God, that's important?
Most people do. Yeah. Most people that I'm showing that tattoo to are around my age and are gay men anyway, so they know that song, they recognize that typeface. Yeah, and most people seem to really love it. You know, I mean, some people roll their eyes about Madonna, but if they're rolling eyes at my Madonna tattoo, they're probably really rolling eyes at my Prince, Pet Shop Boys, and Bananarama tattoos. So, you know.
You're fully decked out.
I am. I'm a record store.
You're wearing a Bananarama shirt at this moment.
I am wearing a Bananarama shirt. Thank you very much. Official.
So tell me about that, like, little 10-year-old, when you got it for Christmas, do you remember, like, unwrapping the CD?
I do. It wasn't a CD. God.
Oh, of course not. Yeah.
I'm old. Yeah. It was vinyl. Yeah. It was the original album, and I do. It was Christmas morning, and, you know, I'm sure I got a shitload of presents, and I really only remember opening True Blue and playing that record start to finish. And, you know, back then, as a kid, I wasn't really aware of the difference between singles and album tracks, and I was just starting to learn, you know? But truthfully, the song that immediately appealed to me was Open Your Heart, which was not yet a single at that point.
Why that one?
I don't know. Because it really was the video later on that solidified it for me, because Felix was in it, and he was my age, and it was like another little boy dancing with Madonna. Like, it was a lot for me as a kid. It spoke to something in me. And the reason I would say that it's the most important piece of art in my life is because it was after that album came out that I started taking dance lessons as a kid, started to take that part of my life and my desire really seriously. And it set me on my path for my life, because I went to school for dance and musical theater, and then immediately moved to New York after that and started working in the music industry. All of it inspired by Madonna, and really most of it inspired by that album.
Wow. So were you like, I want to dance with Madonna?
Yes. I mean, when I was a kid, I just wanted to dance, but ultimately I wanted to dance with Madonna or Michael Jackson or Janet Jackson. But Madonna, I mean, always Madonna, you know?
Did you have people that you could share that music with?
Like, I did. I had three girl cousins who were all within like a year and a half, 2 years of my age. Nikki Heather and Jenny. We were inseparable from the time I was an infant until I was like 15, 16 years old. And we would do dance contests together and choreograph dances in our basement and take dance class together at a real dance studio. And my cousins and I were all really into pop music as kids. And we were all really into Madonna. Really into Madonna. I mean, I like to imagine in my mind that they liked her as much as I did, but I'm sure I was the ringleader there and, like, demanding that they like her. They were my closest friends, my closest confidants, the first people I really related to in terms of music, especially my cousin Heather. She and I just had a real connection from the word go. And she was really obsessed with Madonna when we were little, like, when we were very young.
So were you putting on, like, little, like, Madonna fan concerts?
Oh my god, more than little. I mean, we would start by, you know, choreographing dances for our parents, and we'd just show them in our house, but actually my cousins and I won a really big dance contest in my home state when we were 15 to Vogue.
And tell me about that. What was the contest?
There was a retail store called Steiger's, which was basically like a JCPenney or Montgomery Ward or, you know, Macy's, anything like that. And they had a dance contest. They actually had a lip sync contest the year before, which we also won, doing Simply Irresistible by Robert Palmer. And she's a crazy. And because we won that year, we thought, let's do it again. But they changed it from lip sync to dance. So we choreographed a dance to Vogue. And the three girls were dressed to like Blonde Ambition era Madonna. They had ponytails, you know. And then I sort of approximated a boyish look. I was really jealous, though, that I couldn't wear a bustier and a ponytail. I should have. But yeah, and we entered, and again, we won. And it was completely exciting. It really was.
Did you have anyone who was like, I don't know if this is appropriate for kids, or like, was there any resistance, or was everyone just like, it's so enthusiastic about this?
My mom and dad, I mean, our families were incredibly enthusiastic. I'm really lucky in that I was born into a family, particularly my mother and father, who were just so willing and supportive when it came to what I wanted to do, which was obviously not the typical path of a little boy in a small town in the 80s. So yeah, we were rapturously and enthusiastically supported by our families. And my father sort of ran the rehearsals like, you know, Matthew Knowles. Like, I mean, really, like, he was a taskmaster. He wanted us to deliver.
Wow.
And it was awesome. It really, really was. And again, it's just another example, really, for me, of music, and more specifically Madonna, just having such a huge impact on my development as a young queer boy.
Tell me about that moment of winning the contest. That must have been very exciting.
It was really exciting. Gosh, you know, I do remember that the crowd was so loud. It was so loud. It was a lot of screaming teenagers from our school and from our town. And, you know, in retrospect, I think one of the biggest and most important things for me for winning that contest was because so many people were from my school that were there or that were competing. And it felt like a great thing to win a contest in front of all of them for something that so many of them had made fun of me for doing, because I was such an effeminate. I couldn't pass. I never tried to. And so I was sort of vilified by a certain section of my classmates and certainly administrators. I mean, I'm from a town called Enfield, Connecticut, and the school board, when I was there at the time in the 90s, was totally unsupportive, horrible, hateful people.
What did they do?
Among other things, when I was in high school, I was gay bashed. And rather than deal with the people who had beat me up and had been threatening violence against me, they just made it so that I could graduate early and get out. Which sounds fabulous, you know, to a 16, 17-year-old. I was like, right, get me the fuck out of here. But when I look back now and I think about, you know, an opportunity for education and an opportunity to actually reprimand the people who were attacking me was completely missed because they just didn't want to deal with what they saw as a big problem. The problem being my being gay. that's just one example. I mean, many, many examples. I had teachers call me fag. I had, you know, my guidance counselor tell my parents that they thought it was my fault that kids were making fun of me because I am the way I am. You know, there was a little bit of a fuck you to that win with the lip sync and the dance contest because, yeah, the best revenge is success, right?
What you're describing sounds so much like the climax of a John Hughes movie.
Lower budget than that.
Right, deeper. Right. Yeah. Can you tell me the details of the gay bashing? What happened?
It was kind of systematic gay bashing on a daily basis, mostly verbal. But my junior year, I'd had physical threats of violence, and then I was pushed really roughly into my locker, and I had my locker totally destroyed and vandalized and a fag written all over it. And that, for me, wasn't necessarily a last straw, but it was for my parents. They'd had it. And so they went into the school after that had happened and said, you know, our son doesn't feel protected. You're not protecting our son. And that was when the guidance counselor said, don't you think David brings this on himself a bit with the way he talks, the way he walks? And my parents lost their shit and said, you need to do something about this or else we're going to bring it to the attention of the authorities. And within 24 hours, they'd come back and said, how about if we just give David credits and let him graduate? And that's what they did. And of course, again, a 17-year-old me was like, get me out of here. I'll, you know, and that was it.
Where were you getting out of there to go? Like, had you already decided?
I mean, I knew I was going to go to college, and I knew I was going to go to college in either New York or Philadelphia, and I ended up in Philadelphia at the University of the Arts. But at that point, in November of 1993, I did local community theater and worked at the gas station my father owned, and I did that until I went to college in the fall of 94.
Just jumping ahead a couple of years,
yeah.
So I grew up in a town very close to you, in Southington. You know, so I was there just a couple years after you, and it was around that time that a GSA was starting. And I remember, like, how flabbergasted everyone was that that could happen.
Yeah, well, I mean, so when I came out in the fall of 91 and joined a youth group called Your Turf, which was in West Hartford. Mm-hmm. And through Your Turf, headed up by this amazing gentleman named Bill Mann, who's now a very successful writer of Hollywood biographies, who goes under William Mann, he introduced me to a group of people who had a sort of speaking coalition called the Stonewall Speakers Association. And I joined that immediately, and I spent the school years of 92 and 93 going to different high schools throughout Connecticut speaking about gay and lesbian issues, Southington being one of them. And this was before there were any gay straight alliances anywhere, and Enfield, Connecticut would not allow me to speak at the schools. I wasn't even allowed to speak at my school of being gay. That there would ever be a gay straight alliance anywhere near Enfield, Connecticut seems, even to a 40-year-old me today, unlikely. Although I think they do exist in my hometown. I mean, I haven't really been there in the past 23 years for longer than 2 days. But I was able to, through my mother and father, join that gay and lesbian youth group at a really early age. Thank God. At their suggestion, at their behest. And it introduced me to gay teenagers from a really, really young age.
Did everybody have sort of a similar experience being like, we're sort of the outcasts and we're, I don't know, besieged by the place that we live?
Everyone that was in the youth group was from the surrounding area. Yeah, I mean, definitely. You know, when I think about it, most of the people had much worse situations than I did because they didn't have supportive families even at that time. My town was horrific, but my family was amazing.
Did you find that meeting other gay kids, suddenly there were other people who got this Madonna thing?
Oh my God, yeah. I mean, so, you know, I grew up, of course, desperately just wanting to be friends with anybody who liked Madonna. And my three cousins, who I love dearly to this day, were really good friends and really loved Madonna. But the first male friend I ever had that was really a friend was this wonderful, wonderful, wonderful boy named Matt Marlowe, who was also gay. And we bonded, before we even said we were gay, we bonded over Madonna. And it's funny because it's not so much like that anymore, I don't think. But back in the day, even into college, freshman year of college, you know, I'd long been out of the closet, but there were so many closeted kids my freshman year of college. And the sort of like shorthanded language between, you know, closeted gay kids was to connect on Madonna or any other diva. But it was Madonna, always. So yeah, I mean, certainly that was a major, major difference for me.
Did you keep doing, like, I'm sure in college, like, you had actual performances that were organized through college?
Oh, I did. Yeah, I did. I mean, I was a musical theater major, and I did, like, musicals and things like that. But anyone who knows me, either from my childhood or my college years or anything like that, you know, today, people who meet me, I'm sort of instantly identifiable as a gigantic Madonna fan. It's a really big part of my life. I like to think I'm not like the other crazy fans, but I'm sure I'm just as crazy. I just have more access because of my job.
Have you been, I'm sure, to many concerts?
I've been to every concert, every tour.
Do you remember your first one?
The one I really remember was the Girly Show. When I was 17 and I went with my friend Matt Marlowe, my parents got me tickets for my birthday. They got me tickets for graduation, but it was like 7 months early. It was in October of 1993, and it was the first concert I ever saw at Madison Square Garden. We took the bus to New York, just my friend and I. We were dressed like the dancers in the tour, but we took like a 7 a.m. bus, so all day long we were wearing like sailor pants and striped t-shirts and berets. And we walked around New York, and I shaved my eyebrows, and, you know, I mean, it was just like an incredible experience. And then to be in that auditorium in Madison Square Garden, seeing Madonna and the Girly Show, which at the time I even knew was a really limited run. She wasn't doing any West Coast shows. It was like the ultimate for me. Ultimate. And to this day, it's probably my favorite concert-going experience that I can think of.
What stands out from the concert?
The opening number. Carrie Ann Inaba, who's now a judge on Dancing with the Stars, started the show by entering down a very large stripper pole without a top on to the strains of Erotica. And then Madonna rose out of the floor in the Dita Parlo outfit with the eye mask and the whip and the gold tooth and all that. And, I mean, it was an out-of-body experience for me. Plus, in an arena, I mean, I less remember this and now, and more sort of acknowledge it now, having watched the tour a million times on the DVD, but for an arena show, it's presented like an intimate moment of theater. And I'm sure that resonated with me as a kid because it felt really intimate and it didn't feel like we were watching her from miles away. And, you know, now I can get great seats to any show I want to go to. Back then, it was like nosebleeds or nothing, so...
Do you remember, like, looking around and seeing the other people at this show?
I do. There were a lot of gay men there, and there were a lot of gay men, like Matt and I, who were dressed owing to or feigning Madonna. And like you asked earlier, you know, I mean, like, any gathering of large amounts of queers when I was a teenager, when I wasn't going to gay bars, generally had to do with Madonna or music of some kind. I can remember going to see Paula Abdul on the Under My Spell tour when I was 15, and there were, like, three boys behind... I still remember, which made such an impact on me, because there were three boys my age that were there together with, like, their moms, and they were clearly gay teenagers, and I so badly wanted to turn around and talk to them and be their friend, because they knew all the words. But, you know, I was with, like, my cousins and my mom. You know, it's like... But it was that kind of connection that was made, you know, wherever it was. At a Janet Jackson concert, I remember once, like, seeing a very cute boy when I was, like, 16 and, like, just knowing, like, we both like this stuff, you know. And the older I got and the more I started to, you know, follow this path of pop music and performance and things like that, the less I was able to go back to my regular life in Enfield. My parents let me go and stay overnight in New York alone with a friend of mine when I had just turned 16, and he was 18. He was a freshman at Parsons. And I went to New York, and I stayed overnight for 3 days, and we went to Club USA, and again, I shaved my eyebrows, that was a thing, with a Bic, and we drew them on. And I wore, like, a purple, like, bodysuit. I went to this big club in New York that had a slide in the middle of it. That was Club USA. And there were these two twins there. I can't remember their name. I wish Derek was here right now to tell me. But there were these two twins that had, like, long green braids. And I made out with one of them, these guys. And then I ended up going home with this dancer from NYU. Like, you know, I'm a 16-year-old boy in Enfield, Connecticut. And I, like, went back to his dorm. And I couldn't believe my life. And then on Sunday, I had to get on the bus and go back to Enfield, Connecticut. And it really felt like the end of the world. I can remember thinking, like, I've made out with a man this weekend. I've been to a club with a slide in the middle of it. Like, I've seen people doing drugs. How am I going to go back and turn in my science homework? Let alone deal with these fucking close-minded idiots and assholes, you know? I felt like I was living a double life the second I came out of the closet. Because even being out, I was still having to play by the rules of that small town. It wasn't until I got to college in 94 that I was able to truly start shedding the skin, the armor, really, that you develop as a young gay boy and start expressing myself honestly.
How'd you do that?
Allowing myself to be myself, to not censor the things I like, to not censor the way I talk, the way I walk, the way I relate to people. It was also the environment of my university, which was all musical theater majors and dance majors and things like that, and generally breeds a sort of, you know, gay-friendly, queer-friendly environment. Going there, I never ever had to deal with it. Once I got to college, homophobia was something that happened occasionally instead of something I encountered every single day.
What kind of, what kind of changes did you make? Like, what were you no longer censoring, and how did you express yourself? What was the new David like?
I guess really the main thing I can think of is my voice, my speaking voice, and the way that I walk and move through the world. I do remember a sense of relief walking around Center City, Philadelphia, not having to pretend that I'm straighter than I am, tougher than I am. By tougher, I mean more traditionally masculine. It's those kinds of subtle things. There wasn't any big thing, because I'd already been out of the closet. I'd already been dating men in Enfield, Connecticut, or boys in Enfield, Connecticut. And I'd already been a dancer, and I'd already established myself as a gigantic Madonna fan and those things. But it was all done apologetically, because I was embarrassed, and I was made to feel like I had to be embarrassed for it. So going to college, I was celebrated for these things. I was celebrated for my personality and for my outgoingness and for, you know, all of that. All that kind of stuff that I had learned in my small town to hide from because it made other people uncomfortable. I embraced it when I got to Philadelphia.
Can you tell me about some of the shows that you were in?
Oh my God, yeah. I was in a lot of shows. I was in the Mystery of Edwin Drood. I don't know if you know that show, but it was like an audience participation musical by Maury Esten in the 80s.
The king without a crown, take away his throne and gown. He could be the rabble or the Russian czar. Judge each creature of a race by each feature in his face. Just look at him, I rest my case. Well, there you are.
There you are.
And it matters not to me what part of town you come from. We but cheer you've made it here at all. Here within the garish parish hall, the music hall.
I was in Company by Stephen Sondheim, which is one of my favorite shows.
Who were you in Company?
I was David. And I remember, like, emphatically telling people, like, it's not a character they created for me, it's a real character. I was in a play called Metaphysics of a Two-Headed Calf, which is this, like, absurdist play by a playwright named Vitkevich. I hated every second of that experience. But I did have the lead. I just fucking hated acting. I just didn't... It was not... I just have no respect for the art form as someone who is not an actor. Like, it totally passed me by. I don't like acting. I think it's really boring. Watching it is good when it's good, but I'm just not impressed by actors or impressed by that art form whatsoever. And then the best show I was in was Cabaret. I played the MC. That was my senior year. That was a dream come true. It was the closest to being a pop star that I've ever had. It was, you know, a commanding, singular performance on stage.
Were you not acting when you were in the MC?
I mean, I was acting, but I mean, you know, I was acting like musical theater acting, which is different. I think because also I was such a Madonna fan and a fan of Michael Jackson and Prince and those people, roles like the MC in Cabaret or Bazzard in the Mystery of Edwin Drood, which were less about acting and playing a part more than they were about, or less than they were about a performance, a presentation. I did well in those kinds of things because, you know, the artists I like were never great actors, but they were amazing performers. So
I'm sure, like, yeah, if you want to talk about, like, Madonna's acting career, I mean, she's great.
I don't. And I'm one of the few mega fans, I think, that really I don't like any movie she's been in. I mean, I love Desperately Seeking Susan because it's a commercial for 1985 Madonna.
Orion Pictures presents Desperately Seeking Susan.
Susan! Susan! Susan!
My God, we all thought you were dead.
No, just in New Jersey.
Madonna is Susan. The hottest voice in rock is now the freshest face on film. Every man is desperate to have her. One woman is desperate to be her.
Everybody I know is desperate except you.
I'm desperate.
You?
But someone is desperate to kill her.
Killed?
Come on.
That?
If he can figure out who she is.
Come on. I'm not Susan.
I don't believe it.
My housewife and I live in Fort Lee, New Jersey.
You never stop, do you?
Dick Tracy is no worse for having Madonna in it. A League of Their Own is no worse for having Madonna in it. But I don't think that Madonna playing the roles of Breathless Mahoney or All the Way May made those movies either. You know, I'm on the DVD commentary for Shanghai Surprise, and I'm the only one who doesn't defend her acting.
Are the Madonna fans like, get out?
Oh yeah, I did a roundtable thing with them like 11 years ago for that, and like a lot of them were like, you're talking so badly about her. I was like, well, I don't have to talk badly about her. You just watch the film.
It is true that it's like not. It's hard to be like, oh, what a beautiful performance.
No, I can watch her forever. Right, yeah. Exactly. And I don't think she's compelling on the screen. I think she's beautiful, and I love to watch her do anything, but I feel like a lot of her magic is lost on the big screen. She's great in a 4-minute video. If they gave Oscars for videos, she'd have more than anyone else because she's so effective in her music videos. You'd be hard-pressed to find an actress in Hollywood who's delivered as convincing performances as Madonna has in Bad Girl, Express Yourself, Vogue, Oh Father, Rain, Open Your Heart, Hollywood, Human Nature, Justify My Love. I mean, come on. It's funny, when I think about why I'm such a fan, it's obviously a combination of the music and the videos and the image and all that stuff, but ultimately what it comes down to for me are the records, which I feel like still are leaps and bounds above the catalogs of her contemporaries. I truly believe Madonna's the most consistent singles artist of the rock era, and it's because, like her looks, her music has continually reinvented itself over the years. I mean, I'm a big fan of her most recent album. And when you combine that with the different visuals that she's put out for every record, every single, every tour, every magazine, yeah, it's only David Bowie compares.
When you were in college, I assume you were still like obsessed and following everywhere. But you were also, did you feel like some sort of crisis because you were in like a musical theater program and you were out there performing, but also it sounds like acting was not really your thing?
Well, yeah, I mean, it was a crisis actually, because right when I got to college, I didn't adhere to the idea of like the only kind of singing that's good singing is classic singing. The only kind of voice that's a good voice is a big belty Broadway voice. And, you know, that's what I was learning in that school, obviously, because it was for musical theater. But my mindset was so much more in pop music. And in fact, I remember one of my first classes in a voice for musical theater, they were asking about falsettos, and they were asking, you know, what are some great examples of falsettos? And people were using a lot of theater examples, and I raised my hand and I was like, Prince. Prince has the best falsetto in the world. And my professor at the time was like, I'm talking real singers, he said. And I just remember thinking at the time, like, a real singer. Like, you're saying that this musical theater queen is a real singer, but Prince is somehow not? Anyway, that sort of extended itself into every aspect of what I did. But then I was also in school for musical theater at a time when musical theater was making sort of a comeback in the pop culture pantheon, in that, particular to Madonna, she was doing Evita. That came out my junior year of college.
I kept my promise, don't keep your distance.
And particular to society in general, Rent debuted on Broadway, I want to say, in 1996. Also, I was a junior. So it was really just a matter, like everybody, of finding myself. And I knew probably 2 or 3 years into college that I wasn't going to pursue a career in musical theater. I just didn't know what I was going to do next. I thought I wanted to be a pop star.
Did you try to do that?
No. Because I left musical theater and dance behind because I wanted stability, ultimately. I had a real moment of clarity while I was doing West Side Story in Florida right after college, where I was like, I don't want to audition for my dinner. I don't want to be going through life relying on not just my talent, but also relying on a room full of strangers to decide whether or not I'm good enough. Am I going to get this job? I just really was uncomfortable after college with the sort of open-endedness of my life, and I needed some structure, combined with a real desire to continue on this path that I'd started on when I was around 9 or 10 of wanting to have an exciting pop music-filled life. And it was actually a friend of mine, a friend named Tom Waller, at a Bertucci's in Philadelphia, who said, you should be a publicist. And I didn't even know what one was. And he was like, you love magazines and music more than anyone I know. And that's what publicity is. And so I moved to New York and I got an unpaid internship at a PR firm called Nasty Little Man. And they did press for like Beastie Boys, Foo Fighters, Sonic Youth, Radiohead, loads of bands that I don't particularly like, but who are no doubt, you know, incredible bands. And one of the clients at the time was Robbie Williams, who was this British pop star. And I was a gigantic fan of his. And so I sort of glommed on to that project. And the publicist for him at the time, her name was Shelby Mead. She really liked me. And we're very good friends to this day. She took me under her wing and she gave me my start.
Wow, how did she do that? Like, what were you doing?
Well, I was an unpaid intern and I was answering phones and stuffing envelopes. And one day, I would say probably only 3 weeks after I'd been there, I took the elevator down with her and she like looked at me sort of quizzically in the elevator. And I always tell her this story because it's so Shelby. She looked at me and she was like, what are you doing here? And I was like, oh my God, I'm in trouble. And I was like, well, I'm... And she's like, no, I mean in the bigger picture. Why are you an intern? And I was like, oh, because I want to be a publicist. And she was like, for what? And I was like, well, for pop music. And she was like, you're really good on the phones. Come back tomorrow and I'm going to make you my assistant. And that's what she did. She immediately gave me work to do. I mean, she bestowed on me a lot more responsibility than I probably was capable of, but it was a sink or swim type situation. And so within 9 months of Shelby doing that, I had my own clients, one of them being the Go-Go's. I went out and got them for myself because I wanted a band that I liked.
How did you do that?
I worked with a guy named Perry Serpa on that, and Perry was more senior than me, and he made the connections and the contacts and got in touch with Go-Go's management, who at the time were Beyond. They were called Beyond. And I met all the women in the band except Belinda, and they all really liked me. And then I met Belinda, and she loved me, and we're very good friends to this day.
Were you just, like, over the moon to have the Go-Go's as a client?
I was, because I grew up really obsessed with Belinda. The Go-Go's I was a fan of, but Belinda was the one I was a really big fan of. I've seen her live, you know, all that stuff. I felt really lucky to be working with the Go-Go's. And the Go-Go's were really important to me as a gay man at that time in my life because, again, another first. Like, you know, with a lot of the bands I'd worked with in publicity at that point, like Radiohead, Foo, you know, those kinds of bands, through no fault of theirs, the bands were always amazing. I was uncomfortable because they were straight guys. They were really tough. You know, I was still getting my footing. With those women, I was accepted. They, again, celebrated me for who I was. Belinda really liked me. She liked me. She liked my personality. She liked my voice. She liked the way I talked. You know, like, that was really important for me in the beginning. Because I probably put those women on a pedestal more than I should have at that time in my life. Only because it's just never good to put anyone on a pedestal. But so to have them and Belinda in particular sort of bestow a endorsement on me meant a lot. It meant to me that I could do this job and be myself.
Did you have the same experience that you had with Madonna when it was like, okay, this is something that connects me to other gay men? Like in the music that you were starting
to... Yeah. Well, yeah, again, it's shorthand even today. You know, most of the friends I make in this industry that are gay, we connect because we love similar records. My closest friends in music are this writer Bradley Stern, who has a blog of his own called Mew Muse, but he's also the editor-in-chief of Pop Crush. And a guy I work with, a crush named Charlie Adelman. They're both gay men, and our connection started before we ever worked together, and they started over pop music.
How did, like, what kind of songs?
Britney, period. Although Brad is a gigantic Madonna fan, Charlie says he's a non-fan. But yeah, Britney. Dance pop, ultimately. You know, dance music, dance pop. My friend John Norris from MTV just did a big article about the heritage of Pride and the dance on the pier. And another example of that kind of stuff bringing us together is my friend Derek and I were in the very front row at the dance on the pier when Whitney Houston came out in 1999. And I met John Norris that day. I met this guy, Mark Doctorow, who used to be a producer on MTV that day. Like, gay men who worked at MTV. Like, we just sort of... It's just another example of music bringing queer men together and inspiring a sort of autonomy in that way, you know? It felt very singular.
Can you describe the scene of the dance on the pier?
Madness. I don't even know. I just talked about this with John. Like, I don't remember how I knew, but I found out that morning that Whitney was going to be going from a credible source. And so we cut our parade day short and went and got in line at the pier and then ended up right in the very front row in front of the stage. It was packed. You know, it felt like 100,000 bodies in there, and it was a million degrees, and I was 22. And the most important thing for me at that time, or the most important thing to remember at that time, I think, is that, you know, she was riding at her absolute peak in terms of the dance clubs. It was all the Thunderpuss and David Morales and Junior Vasquez remixes of Heartbreak Hotel, It's Not Right But It's Okay, My Love Is Your Love, I Learned From the Best, all those gigantic songs from the My Love Is Your Love album. They were remixed and they were smashes. And she came out and did the remixed versions of those songs for a gay crowd at Gay Pride. To me, that was the biggest stamp of approval we'd ever had from a mainstream star, particularly a mainstream star with ties to the hip-hop and R&B community. Remember, she was married to Bobby Brown. She'd already moved over into more hip-hop and R&B music at this point. She wasn't, like, making the straight-up ballads that she'd been singing in the 80s. So, not that her endorsement was more important than Madonna's, but it had more resonance in 1999 because we were the collective we, the gay we, were still looked at as a sort of, you know, vilified, abhorrent part of culture, particularly by hip-hop culture.
It sounds like she was sort of straddling something in the same way that your career had for a while with between, like, you know, representing bands of straight guys.
Mm-hmm.
Like, to know, okay, this is a world that I can operate in, too.
Yeah. Getting my start working with bands I didn't listen to was really important because it showed me that I have talent at this, regardless of if I have passion, you know? I mean, that's a lot of of work is just doing work. You know, it's great if you end up working like I do today. I work with my favorite artist in the world and have for 13 years, and I love her music. You know, I mean, she's the best. How could you not? But for what I like, which is pop music, she is truly the best. Starting with those bands and thinking, is this the only kind of music I'm ever going to be able to work with? You know, it's interesting. I don't know. You know, it was a challenge for me, but at the same time, I kind of always knew that I would get there with pop music. I kind of always thought, like, I'll do this for now, and then when I can, I'll go work with a giant pop star. Sia was not a giant pop star when we started working together, but God, it's been an amazing journey getting her there.
Well, yeah, so tell me about that. What brought you to LA? What brought you to Sia?
So I was working with Robbie Williams at Nasty Little Man. I met his management company through that. They were called IE Music. And then I got wind that they were looking for sort of an assistant on the ground in LA, an assistant to Rob and an assistant to the company. I wanted to get out of New York at the time for personal reasons. I just didn't want to live there anymore. And I interviewed to work with IE Music, and I interviewed to work with American Idol for the first season. So they didn't even know who the winner was going to be yet. And I turned down American Idol, and I accepted IE Music. So I moved to LA in September of 2002, started working at IE, and about a year later, Sia moved to LA, and IE was managing her. And my bosses, Tim and David, were basically like, you're going to learn how to be a manager by managing Sia. And she was new enough at the time that I could do that. And she and I just, we hit it off instantly. In a professional way and a personal way. It's a testament to both Sia and myself that we've been able to maintain this kind of relationship for 13 years. Because it's a very close one. And you work very closely together. And those things are difficult to navigate.
Were you nervous about becoming a manager?
I mean, I'm still nervous. I'm a nervous person by nature. I don't remember being nervous, like, in the broad sense of the term. But every first is a first. And so, yeah, I was nervous the first time we went on tour. I was nervous the first time I had to take Sia to a writing session. You know, she didn't drive, so I had to pick her up and take her at the time. And, yeah, it was nerve-wracking. It's always nerve-wracking when you get close to what you've wanted.
What was that like, that first, like, tour, for example?
Oh, I mean, that first tour was a nightmare because touring is a nightmare. And we were all on one bus, meaning me, Sia, the band, the crew, like, you know. But it was exciting, too. I should not leave that part out. Like, when you don't know better, you just know what you know. And so I thought, at the time, I remember the first time I got on the tour bus, I was like, oh my God, this is amazing, I'm on a tour bus, you know. That's easy to say in retrospect, you know? Like, now I'd look at a tour bus and get chills and feel sick. But it is what it is. But yeah, it was nerve-wracking. You know, I've been really lucky to work with incredible teams of people. The company I work for now, Crush Music, it's run by Jonathan Daniel and Bob McClinn. And, you know, they run the show. I'm an expert in Sia, and I'm a conduit between what Sia does and the rest of the world, you know, like, I'm her manager, but I'm part of a team. I mean, Jonathan is her manager, Bob is her manager, I'm her manager, and we have an enormous team of people that work unfucking believably hard to keep the Sia train running. At the helm of it all is Sia.
Is there stuff about that position that you're in now that reminds you of being that little kid who was looking up to Madonna and
constantly
being a part of the Madonna train?
Daily. Yeah, daily. First of all, we are working with Madonna's tour manager. He's our tour manager now. So that feels exciting. But more so, I would say that every day for me, this job is a reminder of the 10-year-old kid. Because I exist now in a world of my own making. And it's a dream world in a certain way. It's a job. It's as stressful as any other job. It's as hard as any other job. There's disappointments like any other job. There's amazing highs like any other job. But the part that really resonates to the 10-year-old in me is that this untouchable fantasy world that seemed like the antithesis of the place I was growing up in, and that a place that I would never be able to get to, was always within my grasp. You know, all I ever wanted to do was work in music.
David, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I'm such a fan of what you do, and I'm really appreciative. Thank you.
Yay.
Thanks again to David for joining me. In talking to him, I realized another reason gay men might love powerful women: their ability to adapt, to transform, to reinvent themselves, and always stay one step ahead of everyone else. Speaking of quick changes, for my recommendation this week, I suggest you run to YouTube and look up the incredible drag act 20 Years of Madonna in 20 Minutes. I've also posted the video in the show notes for this episode, which you can find at sewersofparis.com. It's an incredible costume-changing lip-sync medley of Madonna's entire career, performed by a San Francisco artist named Kimo. Half of the pleasure of the show is hearing one greatest hit after another, and the other half is witnessing the dizzying, frantic exchange of costumes and dresses and wigs and completely different looks within seconds. It's easy to forget just how many Madonnas we've had from the 80s to today, from Starlight to Material Girl to Open Your Heart to Like a Prayer to Vogue, and that barely even gets us into the 90s. Watching Kimo rocket through Madonna's career is an incredible reminder of just how many times she's changed. And I think that knack for transformation is one key to Madonna's ongoing success. When you hit on something that works, there's a temptation to keep riding it and riding it and riding it and riding it. After all, if something you did worked, if people love it, that seems like the riskiest possible time to change. But risks can be won, not every time, and you may need to adjust your definition of what winning means. But imagine if Madonna never moved on from Material Girl. Those furs would be pretty threadbare by now. You may not love all the risks she takes, but if you don't, so what? There'll be another quick change soon enough. Thanks again for listening. As always, I love to hear your thoughts on the show. You can reach me at Matt Baume on Twitter. If you're enjoying the show, please do head over to sewersofparis.com and click support the show on Patreon. Each episode takes around 10 hours to produce, from searching for subjects to recording conversations to editing out ums and editing in clips. You can keep Sewers going by pledging as little as a dollar an episode, which makes you a part of the Sewers family. Thanks to everyone who left iTunes reviews. We're finally over 200 ratings in the iTunes store, so hooray! Jason DeRose writes of the show, "Imagine a gay male Terry Gross." Jason, I can't even tell you how many times I've imagined such a thing. By the way, check out my other podcast, Defining Marriage, where we joke about the week's gay marriage news, and my book of the same name, which tells stories of people who fought for marriage over the last 40 years. You can get them both at definingmarriage.com. And until next time, croissant.